This is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader. Stay tuned, and you'll hear what you'll hear.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is on the ear. I know you don't know what life is really worth. It's a heart that needs a cold after story had never been told. So now you see the light. Hey, stand up for your right. Come on,
get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
And this is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader. We're here every Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, if you're listening live. And I don't know what time that is anywhere else. All I know is that's where it is Eastern Time. So come east or listen some other time, wherever it is your time. And, of course, it's available worldwide on the web. If you're listening in Somalia, thank you very much for tuning in. This is a day today when there are hearings in the Senate for Mr. Brennan, John Brennan, who is the president's murderer-in-chief. And he wants to appoint him the head of the CIA. You get a look at this guy. There are pictures of him in the paper. If you don't know what the caption was, and then somebody substituted a caption, Mafia head, James Bartolozzo, being led to the Senate chamber to testify by federal marshals. The guy looks the same way. He's a thug, only he's a very intelligent thug, probably educated by the Jesuits, I think. So he's going to testify today because he's been appointed. Obama wants him to be the head of the CIA. Well, he's already the head of the CIA. The CIA is sort of one of his he used to work at the CIA for a long time, which presumably, I guess, could give somebody credentials to be the head of an organization where you worked for many years. But his real claim to fame over the last several years is he's really the chief, I don't know what the euphemism is, he's the chief security advisor for President Obama. He advises him on basically how to fight his wars, where to fight his wars, and specifically, they're going to ask him today if they have any guts, I don't know, but they're going to ask him today about his drone war. Brennan is Mr. Drone War. He's the guy who sits with the president every Tuesday and helps make the final decision on who to blow up all over the world with your tax money. And he defines who it is that's a terrorist based on his, on the gathered intelligence of the National Security Agency and other people. And maybe he does have a title. I don't know. But he is basically the president's he's a war concierge for the president. You know what I mean? He sits there and they go over all these reports from the NSA, from the CIA, from various other intelligence sources. And they pick out the terrorists and the great enemies of the United States and launch Predator drone strikes against them. Once in a while, a cruise missile. But mostly Predator drone strikes, because these things are in foreign countries where the Congress has never declared a war. Right? Do you remember the Constitution back in those good old days? Remember the Constitution? We used to have crank-up cars, and they had plug-in radios, and they had something called the Constitution. And the Constitution says in there that if the President of the United States wants to declare a war, thinking how serious that is, to put the lives of American, now it's men and women, at stake in combat, sending them overseas where we don't belong unless there's an emergency that affects our country or perhaps our close allies, all the money that's spent and the blood that's shed and the killing that's going to be done, not just the, our troops being killed, but the fact that Americans will kill other people in foreign countries. Well, of course, the president is required. I mean, it's not his personal army, is it? It's not supposed to be. He's required to go to Congress where the representatives of the people of the United States are to be consulted on whether or not there is ample justification to have a war. Now, sometimes it's been pro forma, and sometimes it's for real. You know, maybe it's a little bit of both. When Roosevelt went to Congress after December 7th, you know, there was a fever pitch. And after all, the Japanese had just, you know, sort of suddenly, people argue about how suddenly it is, but those that's for the history books, had suddenly invaded Pearl Harbor in our base in Hawaii, in our military base in Hawaii, and killed eventually, I think the total was something like 1,600 service people and probably a few civilians. And they attacked us. They declared war on us. Well, the response is pretty clear. And aside from whatever the real reasons for war for fighting with them, and then there was the patriotic fervor, the, you know, the Japs, another form of gook, right? We've been fighting the gooks in the Philippines and all over the world. And so another version of high-tech gooks had attacked the United States of America. We can't get, we can't let them non-Christian gooks get away with this stuff. After all, they did actually attack us. It was a violent, vicious act. People had reason to suspect that the West Coast might be in danger. Who knew, right? And, of course, it was a clash of two empires. Anyhow, Roosevelt goes there and he says I want you, he says, to the representatives of the people of the United States to declare war. The president cannot declare war. People don't understand that anymore. Since we're in a state of permanent war, because the chicken hearts in the Congress gave that power to the president through the Patriot Act, since where there's a permanent war on terror, whatever that means, that also, by the way, includes anybody who stands out in the street outside of Goldman Sachs and says that it's wrong that they have all the money and nobody else has any, those are terrorists too. But we're in a permanent war against terror, according to everybody who should know better than us, and we should just shut up and listen to them. A permanent war against terror. So there's never been anything like this in the history of the United States. It's probably existed in other countries, you know, this kind of state of war. But there's no specific country that we're declaring war against. There's no specific army that we're declaring war against. And you could say, well, that's not the way modern war is. It's guerrilla warfare. It's insurgents. It's people with dirty bombs sneaking across borders. It's cyber hackers, right? Yeah, war is different than it used to be. Nevertheless, that's not an excuse to rip up the Constitution and use it for, you know, to line the bottom of your birdcage. But that's what Bush and Obama together have done. And one is just as bad as the other. So now that we have a permanent war against terror, the president has a blank checkbook. You know, he can fund any amount of wars anytime he wants. The Congress never does much about it, even though it is also their job to fund wars or to withhold funds from wars. The Defense Department and actual, you know, like every year they take a look at the war in Iraq, or now it's the war in Afghanistan, or the war in Somalia or Yemen, just fill in the blank, and they have to approve once again the amount of money. So that's the job. The president, who is the chief executive, basically, he's like the CEO of the country. He sort of runs the thing. And he goes to Congress, who represent the people, and he says, I want you, in the name of all the citizens of the United States and the taxpayers, to declare war on this country because they are a threat, they're an imminent threat to the United States of America's survival. You're sitting there right now, listen to this. Do you believe that people in Yemen and that people in Somalia and people running around in the mountains of Pakistan or in Afghanistan are an imminent threat to the security of the United States of America? Do you really believe that? Well, the president has got a guy, John Brennan, who meets with him every Tuesday, apparently, and goes over a list of people who will be killed in drone strikes. The CIA does this surveillance. You need an excuse for this? No problem. The president says to the Justice Department, they're his appointees, right? So they're not going to disappoint him unless they want to quit because they're honest. And they write up, he says, give me a legal reason why there's a legal reason under the Constitution or even under some tenuous, strange, abstract executive power, while I'm allowed to blow up anybody all over the earth any way I want with American taxpayers' money and using American troops or whatever, or drones. And the Justice Department, what do you know? They find out. There's a reason, and they write him all these papers, and they give him legal justification for it. So then he says to Congress, I've got legal justification for this. Don't worry about it. Would I lie to you? I'm the president. You don't have. Then they say, well, let's take a look at it. After all, it's our responsibility to approve extraterritorial killing by the United States forces. And he says, you know, go screw yourself. I'm the president. I just said it's legal. Mind your own business. And they say, you know what? It is our business. And they, and the president has said, you know, forget about it. I'm not showing it to you. Now, when he wants them to approve his pick for the head of the CIA, this guy Brennan, he's finally just yesterday releasing this paper, a paper that the Justice Department made up, which is a partial list of the reasons and the excuses and the justifications legally, theoretically, why we're able to go all over the world and kill whoever we want, and also specific cases. The people in the Senate and the Congress, rather the Senate and the House, who are head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, whatever it is, the, you know, who oversee these things, they said, we want not only to see your generalized abstract reasoning, which provides the excuse to use our taxpayer money to go off and murder people overseas, but we want to see each specific case. And they have every right to see that, because every single time there's a drone strike anywhere in the world, and there are many, many drone strikes. Several thousand people at this point have been killed, about 25% of them estimated to be civilians, probably about half, actually. Now, every single time they do that, they have to, according to the Constitution, and I'm not a constitutional lawyer, but a simple reading of it can tell you that, they have to actually give it a, you know, a reason for why they're doing this. Now, the president's attitude is that there's a war on terror. For instance, during World War II, President Roosevelt didn't have to go to the Congress every single time, you know, he, a general, Eisenhower, every time Eisenhower wanted to send, like, the 8th Army over here or the 3rd Army over there or send the 8th Air Force over France or bomb a target or launch an invasion of Sicily. President didn't go over to Congress and say, this is what we're doing. We're going to invade a certain portion of Holland, and I need your approval. People understood World War II, we're at war with the Nazis and with the Japanese Empire, and he will fight it the way he sees fit. They gave him the original go-ahead, and they kept approving the money for him to do it. All very clear, right? And sometimes they would exercise oversight to find out what was going on, and if it was something that was too secret, they didn't tell the American people. You sort of understand that, right? But here in this case, the president has, and as Bush did, and as Obama's doing, they have decided that there's a permanent war. Now, there is such danger, such obvious danger to the very foundations of democracy in declaring a state of permanent war. And the Congress, it's an astounding combination of passivity, timidity, opportunism, political opportunism, and patriotic fervor and executive power, an incredible combination, none of which really has very little to do, anything to do with democracy, as far as I can tell. Very little to do, if anything. So all these things combined, they passed the Patriot Act, and then recently, I don't know, a few years ago, they renewed the Patriot Act, and they keep renewing all these things that the president can do. We're in a permanent state of war. This is like something out of a futuristic novel, or what was once a futuristic novel by Huxley or Orwell or something like that. There is a picture on a screen. These guys were prophets. You know, a really great artist is also a political and a cultural prophet. They know what the future is like. So what you'll see is some picture on a screen somewhere of the leader. There's not even a name anymore. The leader doesn't have to have a name. This is what's happening in this country. It's the leader, like Der Führer, you know what I mean? It's a generic title of somebody who is in charge of everything, who knows better, and you better do what they say or else. And the leader, if he decides that he's attacking Oceania or Transoceania or whatever it is, and he gives you a reason for it, you're supposed to say, right, he must be right. There are enemies, and this is what they want you to do. You're a consumer of patriotism. The same way that corporations and advertising build up The average person in America's, hypnotic trance-like desire for products, patriotism is also a product that the government sells you with the unwitting and witting cooperation of major media organizations. So when you watch the Super Bowl or the Orange Bowl or the Toilet Bowl or whatever bowl game you're watching, if you watch any sports event, if you watch anything at all on TV, a flag is waving. If somebody drives a Dodge Ram truck across the screen, there's a goddamn flag on it, or there's one waving in the background, right? They are selling patriotism. And when we read these books, like I read them in high school, you read them, I don't know if they still teach Huxley. They teach Huxley and Orwell? They teach those books in school? I don't know. But I guess it's out of style. But people in America would do well, these are British authors, to read Brave New World and 1984. These books, when they were written back in the 30s or back in the 40s, were completely prophetic of what our life is right now, right? Or even movies. People who make Hollywood movies have more of an understanding of our cultural dynamic and what it's going to make the future look like than any politician, head of a think tank, or Harvard political science professor. Any the people who wrote The Terminator and the people who wrote Blade Runner and all those movies, they know goddamn well exactly what the future is going to be like because it's happening. They can see the cues and the clues right in front of them. So anyhow, Brennan today, actually in just a few minutes at 2:30, he is going to be testifying in front of Congress, and they are saying, some of them, in fact, more than you would expect from these prostitutes and from these pimps, they're very angry, they say. They're going to grill him, which is a kind of a newspaper word, right? You know, they're going to grill him. They're going to put him through the ringer. This guy, Brennan, is such a hard case that you could hit him with a shovel, you could threaten his mother and everything else, and he would just sort of blink at you like a lizard, right? It doesn't make any difference to him. But they're going to grill this guy, who's the president's chief murder advisor, and they're going to say, where do you get off violating the authority of Congress by taking it into your own hands to kill people without even justifying it legally? And this white paper that you gave us, this is so much jive. And we finally get it after the president wants you to be the head of the CIA. Up until yesterday when he released this paper with these theoretical legal justifications, up until yesterday, they were treating us like we were roaches in the corridors, that we had no rights whatsoever. We didn't even represent the people. Now suddenly we have it because he wants something. He wants you to be the head of the CIA. Where do you get the justification for this? Where do you get the nerve to do this? Who are you to be deciding life and death? Now, I don't believe in God, right? But this guy, Brennan, thinks he's God, that he can look down from his perch in the sky, you know, or maybe from a Predator surveillance drone relayed back to him, and he can throw thunderbolts down on people literally and blow them up because he decided that they're evil. It sounds like something from the Old Testament. And you know what? There's no surprise that it does, because guys like this, like Brennan, had this kind of, who are brilliant guys, right, who had this kind of like Jesuit, like semi-biblical, you know, education infused into whatever else. I'm sure he had a first-rate education, but there's this biblical, religious, theme that's infused into his worldview, which is there are people who are evil and there are people who are good. There's right and there's wrong. And those people running around in that desert, you know, who are holding a Kalashnikov or meeting in a hut somewhere, they are evil people. They are tools of the devil. Now, Brennan's not going to say that. He's a sophisticated guy, right? And he may not even believe it himself, but it's inside him. The president is getting advice from a guy who is really a kind of vicar of drones. He's kind of the bishop of drone strikes, right? You know, he's a religious character in his own way. And he believes with a religious fervor that there's evil in the world. Now, he may not call it that because it doesn't look good in the press. It doesn't sound good for his confirmation, but he may actually believe that. He probably does. I have no idea what the president believes. That guy is cold as ice. I don't even know if he believes anything. I really don't. And, of course, he doesn't feel called upon to justify himself to anyone. He takes it as an affront to his dignity and to the power and prestige of his office to have to justify himself. He was only elected president by the people. What is obviously the uniting theme of these comments here is that you and I and the rest of the people who live in this country, the citizens of the United States, the taxpayers of the United States, are absolutely meaningless to these people. They have broken away from any kind of responsibility to us. They have broken away from any feeling of obligation to us. They forget that they work for us. These guys work for us. Theoretically speaking, we could fire them. But I don't recommend going down to the office there and handing them a pink slip. They'll throw you in Guantanamo. But we could fire them. They're supposed to work for us. They forget this if they ever knew it in the first place. Things have gotten that far that anybody who's at that level couldn't care less what the effect is. Now, there are people who will back them up and say, the kinds of people that they're after are some of the worst people in the world. And you know what? I agree. Some of the people that they want to blow up and turn into just, you know, dust. You can't even identify the people after these drones hit them. They incinerate them or blow them to pieces that can't even be constructed together. Now, some of these people are some of the worst people in the world. But individually, they're driving a truck or a Honda pickup truck somewhere around in some godforsaken, you know, scorpion-ridden desert somewhere, plotting to do what? Attack the United States? Well, of course not. They're not going to attack the United States. You know, all they've got is their truck. They can't even get to the coast. I don't even know if they have enough gas to drive there. They're not a threat to the United States. But people like Brennan and Obama will say, look at 9/11. Look at the other thousands of threats that we have tracked down and we have prevented from happening. You're lucky that we're on the job. Okay, then show it to me in great detail. We don't need all this secrecy. If you tell me that you're protecting me by these FBI investigations and these CIA investigations and then extrajudicial murders and renditions and tortures, and you think there's no torture anymore, give me a break, right? So if you think you're doing all this, this is such extreme behavior. If you're using murder and torture and other interrogation techniques, if you're spending billions of dollars that could be used to help old people and children and everybody else, if you're doing all this, then get on the TV with a chart. Get on the radio. Lay it out every day then. You know, you're doing this crap. Lay it out, right? Don't tell me, yeah, when and if you believe that they're really dangerous, you don't want to tell them in advance on TV when and where you're going to strike them. Obviously, you don't want to do that, right? No more than anybody wanted to tell, the Nazis, hey, you know what? We're going to land on Normandy. So don't worry about that other fake out that we tried, right? You don't tell people if they're really your enemies. I understand that. But these people have taken secrecy so far that they have created a distance from us, which makes them almost like a separate group of people. They rule over us the same as any monarchs ever ruled over any group of people. They have no interest in what you think, no interest whatsoever. In fact, the only interest they have in what you think or how you feel when you're protesting these things or when you're angry about it is to define you as a potential terrorist. The equations have been made over and over again by these people. There are drones that, you know, not all the drones are flying overseas in Yemen and Somalia. A lot of the drones are flying in this country. There are drones at work now, operated by the Defense Department. This is no joke. Believe me, I'm not making this up. You know, this is not left-wing conspiracy nutcase time. There are actual government drones used by local police, state police, and the Homeland Security and the Defense Department flying around in the United States. They tell us they're not armed. And I guess that works up to the point that you're walking down Broadway and all of a sudden half a block disappears. But so far they tell you that they're not armed. They're just surveilling. You know, they're looking at things. What are they looking at? Terrorism. And this is what else they do, right? They've taken technology and corporate marketing, analysis, and they've applied it just the way McNamara tried to do during the Vietnam War. And look how well that worked. They try to apply flow charts and systems and metrics and corporate analysis and, sales charts and everything to war. So in other words, what they'll do is they've come up with something identified as suspicious behavior, which is what the police always called suspicious behavior. This goes back decades. But now they've come up with something. I forget the exact phrase. It's a pattern of suspicious behavior shown from 20,000 feet or 4,000 feet to a drone or a surveillance or a satellite, if they see a bunch of guys in the desert milling together who appear to be between 15 and 35 or 15 and 40, and this is from, you know, 1,000 miles up or even 1,000 yards up, or it's from space. If they see this happening and there's a gathering of activity and they see things that look like weapons, they can blow you up. They have allotted to themselves the right of, like God, to blow you up literally from the sky because you look suspicious. It was no more than a couple of months ago, I think, that they were tracking in Yemen. They were tracking some al-Qaeda guys. And by the way, the people who get blown up all the time, you know, the ones that make the newspapers are, the CIA informs the newspapers that they have recently, I don't know what word they use, they have a choice of euphemisms that they use. They have recently eliminated a threat in Yemen, which is to say they took out, and how many times did you read this before you start feeling you are in a novel somewhere or in a movie? Think about it. Add it all up. Just think about it right now. You don't have to have the papers in front of you. It seems like every week the Pentagon announces that they have killed, or whatever word, eliminated the man who is assistant in charge of al-Qaeda. How many times have they killed this person? Or the person who's in charge of Abla province in Somalia or Yemen, they have taken out the leader of, or the assistant leader, or the deputy leader of al-Qaeda. Well, really? So that's what, 50 times they did it? 100 times they killed it already? Now, if they haven't killed the same guy over and over again, in Vietnam they had body counts where they just multiplied the same person, you know, to keep the war going. If they haven't actually killed the same person over and over and over again and kept saying that it's somebody else, then maybe it is somebody else, right? But what does that tell you? It doesn't work. If they blow up the guy who's assistant in charge, well, then somebody else becomes the assistant in charge. Now, a couple of months ago, they found a bunch of guys in Yemen, right? And these are, you know, from their intelligence sources, and I'm willing to believe it enough, right, who said that these are al-Qaeda guys. Usually they're low level, which brings up another question is why spend, what is a missile strike and the use of a drone as far as fuel and the building of a drone? Factor in the building of a drone, which is what, probably they cost like $20 million each one, $50 million a drone. Then the missiles, probably each one is $100,000 because of cost overruns and some crap that somebody's getting rich off us, right? So let's say you spend $1 million on a drone. I don't know, $25,000 on one missile, right? And then they're paying the salaries, and pretty good salaries, of the strange schizophrenic lunatics who sit in front of consoles in upstate New York or out in Las Vegas and operate these drones and blow people up from 12,000 miles away. All of this costs a lot of money, right? And who do they wind up killing? Well, once in a while they'll tell you it's the head of something else. And sure enough, then there's a new head. So obviously it doesn't work. Secondly, it's come out in the newspapers recently and studies that of the people who have been killed, which is why Congress wants to know this stuff. These people get away with murder. And they get away with lying, and they make things up. And Congress, you know, some people in Congress feel like they want to stop this. They want to slow it down or stop this. They feel like it's gotten far out of their control, out of their legal and moral control. And they're right. It has gotten far out of their control. So, you know, maybe $1 million is spent blowing up some low-level guy with an automatic rifle driving around in a beat-up old, you know, surplus Russian Jeep in the desert. And it's a great victory for the United States of America. Make you feel better? Makes me feel better. I'm up there in my apartment on 106 and Broadway in Manhattan, and I'm sitting in a living room, and I pick up the paper, and I see that Abla al-Fadaba got blown up in Somalia. Man, I feel so much better. I was afraid to go out to go buy tomatoes, you know? This is what they're doing in our name. It should enrage us all. It should drive us crazy with rage that these people have taken unto themselves the powers of God in our name and used all this money, which could be used. They want budget cuts now, right? They want budget cuts in education, environmental protection. We're all dying of pollution, right? They want budget cuts in everything that affects human beings in this country to blow people up who they say are criminals in other countries, right? So about 2 months ago, they identified a bunch of males, you know, and they've got beards and they've got these funny things around their heads and they look like things that could be weapons. Maybe they're sticks, but who knows, right? And our metric, our pattern identifies them. Since Jeeps are driving together and they're meeting at night, they must be a threat to the United States of America. We need to blow them up. So a bunch of guys are meeting, right? And this is what happened 2 months ago, which is a perfect example of one thing that's very wrong with all of this crap. Is there was a guy in Yemen, a very influential tribal sheikh or a tribal leader in Yemen, who did an unbelievable thing. He stood up to these murderers, to these lunatics. I'm not supporting them, you know. I'm not saying that they're, you know, heroes of some revolution. These are thugs and religious nuts and murderous people too. So he stood up to these people. He was a powerful tribal leader in Yemen. He said, wait a minute, this is my tribe. This is my area, the desert here, you know, my patch of Yemen. And I represent the people. He's got more responsibility to his own people than the president has to us, right? And he says, I don't like these people. And he denounces Al-Qaeda, right? Amazing, right? He puts his life in jeopardy to do this. And they threaten him. And he says, we better have a meeting. So they get together and they're Al-Qaeda, you know, sort of mid-level Al-Qaeda groups in Yemen. And they're arguing with this guy in some village someplace. The CIA has been following them for days and days and days, sees them all, decides that the metric or the pattern is correct, blows them all up, including this guy who is a powerful Yemeni tribal authority who is standing up to Al-Qaeda. Another case, somebody... And now they keep widening their definition of who's a threat to the United States of America, to you listening to and to me, right? Who's a threat to us, right? To our little kids going to school in Dayton, Ohio. Who's a threat? Anybody who it looks like he could be of military age, who's anywhere within a certain distance of somebody who we think is a terrorist. Jesus Christ, if I was a judge in New York State Supreme Court, and a cop came to me and he said, we had to shoot at these people, and he gave me that reason, I would order him in contempt of court. I'd have him thrown off the police force and indicted for murder. And yet these people get away with it. So, anyhow, as I speak, they're opening up the hearings in Washington to confirm this guy Brennan. First of all, he should never be confirmed to be the head of anything, except maybe if he wants to quit the government and get a job working for what's left of the Bonanno family, you know, when they're having a war with each other. That's what I think of this guy, right? He is a cold-blooded, out-of-control mass murderer, and he shouldn't be serving the people of the United States or being paid with my money or talking to the president of the United States, who a lot of people voted for. I didn't. I wouldn't. But this guy is going to, and they say they're going to grill him. Well, I'll believe that when I see it or when I hear it. The hearings will be on C-SPAN probably on TV. And if you, I'll tell you what. If I see in this day and age with this bunch of, you know, sheep, this bunch of prostitutes in Congress, senators and congressmen, if I see them give him a hard time and actually say, you know what? You have no right to be doing this. Where do you get your authority in the Constitution? I don't think I want to approve of murder overseas. You haven't justified it to me. You should be maybe even ashamed of yourself acting this way. And then read out a list of all the civilians that have been killed. And something like 1,800 or 1,500, the numbers vary depending on what report you use, women, children, babies, wedding parties. By the way, I was talking about patterns and metrics before. Guess what looks exactly like an Al-Qaeda meeting to a predator drone and a surveillance drone, a wedding party, a funeral party. They blow those up all the time. I was like no more than 4 or 5 months ago, they blew up some meeting in a village and something like 25 or 30 innocent people were killed. They were getting together to have a discussion about irrigation or something. But it looked like to a machine, to Skynet flying around up there, or Arnold Schwarzenegger, whoever it is who makes these judgments, it looked like they were terrorists. Okay, so Brennan, the guy in charge of all this, the guy who invented it, the guy who does it, the guy who relishes, obviously, murdering people and gives advice to the president, and he does it too, this guy is supposed to be I would not only not approve him, I would tell him, you know what, if I were you and I was a decent man and I wanted to do the honorable thing and I wanted to actually protect the United States, instead of blowing people up all over the world and recruiting terrorists every time you do this, you know when a Read these reports about drone strikes. There was a study by some people at Stanford University and somebody else, and the UN is studying this now. Where these drones, they hover over an area for 24 hours in a row, 48 hours in a row. Other ones come in. They hover over an area, and they fly over an area slowly. People can hear them. They can see them. They can't shoot them down for some reason, but they can hear them and see them, and they make a buzzing noise. They hover over an area. There are reports that there are tens of thousands of people in the areas where these drones have struck people and where they hover all the time looking to strike more people, where children have become mentally unstable. They're afraid to leave the house. People are afraid to send their kids to school because kids have been blown up because they appear to be terrorists to these drones and to some cold-blooded, schizophrenic lunatic sitting at a console on an Air Force base in upstate New York. How far have we come from human behavior of a sensible and decent sort? There's no more morality here. And this guy Brennan should be soundly refused to be, and it should be a sign to the president that people in the form of their representatives won't put up with this anymore. I'll tell you what I was going to say before. If I see them give Brennan a hard time or tell him they have no intention of allowing him to be the CIA director because he has violated the morality and the basis of democracy in America, I will put my hand on a Bible. Do we have a Bible? No Bible. You see, that is what's wrong with the modern world. I come down to this radio station, and there's not even a Bible here. There's no wonder everything is going to hell, right? Okay. If you find a Bible, don't bring it in here. Don't interrupt me. But I will put my hand on a Bible, and I don't even believe in it. And I will swear that I will support the Democratic Party in the next election if I see them grow a set of balls today and question this guy the way they should. Or anybody. Every one of those congressmen who get to see him, every one of those senators who question this guy today should be morally outraged as Americans about his behavior and about his boss's behavior. We'll see what happens. I'm going to take a little break now. We'll come back. Okay, we're back. This is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader. If you're just tuning into the show for the first time, it's called Occupied Territory, not because it's about what goes on in the West Bank or in Palestine. It's because it was based and founded, this show, on the activities and the goals of the Occupy movement, which is to say income inequality, which is the root of all evil in this country, and really is there. There is class warfare, and we're all losing it. Also, alternative politics. Clearly, the Democratic and Republican parties, in general, most of the time, do not represent us anymore, as we can obviously see from what goes on. What is it? The ratings of Congress, the popularity in the ratings of Congress are below that of the Communist Party, which doesn't even exist anymore. It's pretty bad when you don't do as well as a party which disappeared in 1959 or whatever, and maybe roaches or, you know, syphilitic rats. That's what people think of the people in Congress. And they are clearly bribed by rich people. They are owned and operated by rich people, as is the president. So that's what this show is. It's called Occupied Territory because corporations and the rich have occupied the Supreme Court, the White House, and both houses of Congress. That's why it's called Occupied Territory. And what we try to do in this show is bring you information you may not see elsewhere, and also to try to, I suppose, keep these things in the public view. When the Occupy movement first started, and the whole time it was, you know, boiling hot until they all got disbanded by Homeland Security and the cops in the most violent, unconstitutional way. Until then, the papers either ridiculed the Occupy movement or ignored it entirely. Why? Well, it's obvious. The papers, I say, also the media, TV media, because they're owned by the corporations that these groups were protesting. So no way you're going to even hear about it or find out anything decent about them. Now, I'm going to make a segue here. Since I'm talking about people, as I've said over and over again, the president and the Congress, who don't represent us anymore, even though they want us to vote for them, and they say, well, look, we're not as bad as the other guys. You should vote for us. Yeah, right. Okay, sure. Not me. I didn't vote for them, and I didn't vote for any Democrats. You know, these guys are way gone as far as I'm concerned. They don't care about democracy. So considering these are the people who are examining this guy Brennan and saying they're going to grill him and people are going to like pass gun laws, they're not going to do crap. They're not going to do anything. If they do something, I will say it out loud here and I will apologize and say that I am pleased with what they did. But stay tuned for the next few years. I doubt you'll hear it. Now, speaking of alternatives to regular political processes and to the regular democratic authoritative process of elections, which is now bankrupt and utterly corrupt, it doesn't help any of us anymore. What we have left is something outside the political system, outside the law, outside the political system. I'm talking about massive civil disobedience, maybe riots. I'm actually even talking about riots. I'm not telling people to go out on the street and hurt anybody or burn anything down. I'm merely recounting what I have read very clearly as the history of the United States. All through the history of the United States, and as recently as, let's say, the Civil Rights Movement, ending the war in Vietnam in the 60s, and maybe the World Trade Organization protests, although that hasn't achieved anything yet except repression. But as an author who I'm going to mention in a minute points out in this fantastic new book that I'm reading, one of the best books I have ever read, and I've read a good number of books in my time, this is one of the best nonfiction, historical, philosophical books I have ever read. And I mentioned it. I want you to go to the Facebook page. I should have mentioned that earlier in the show. Maybe I did, but I forget. There's a parallel or accompanying a Facebook page that goes with this show where I post sort of sermons or rants like I just made, or analyses, if you want to be polite about what I just did, you know, or journalistic. I post these information and these sort of essays on the Facebook page called Occupied Territory. So in addition to this show, which is on every Thursday at 2 p.m., and sometimes I have guests on here, the show after this, I think it's the one after that, I have a very interesting guest who's written about something called the commons and the history of common ownership of property and means of production, and, you know, and not to be too, you know, cant in my language. But this is a guy who's writing about the legitimate history of people owning things in common and how basically governments aligned with the rich have taken every single piece of property and every mineral right and the water even and the air and taken it away from us and privatized it. Whereas the only way that human beings, he says, can survive in a decent way with some sense of dignity and equality is the commons. So I have guests on like that. He'll be on in a couple of weeks. But go to the Occupied Territory Facebook page. Well, I will post these essays. I will also put, you know, give you the websites for people who I think are really interesting, new books. If you have something to say, go there and post the information yourself. And either I'll look at it and comment on it, or I'll just respond, or other people will respond. Now, the book I'm reading right now is called Two Cheers for Anarchism. Two Cheers for Anarchism by James C. Scott. And it's one of those books that you come across every once in a while that seems to explain everything. This guy is so brilliant. He's so learned and so brilliant and has such a beautiful way of putting things clear. And he writes very well. James C. Scott, he's written other books. He's a professor of environment and of social systems and politics up at Princeton. And this is an amazing, or is it Yale? Hold on, wait a minute. Look at the book. Got it right in front of me. Sterling, professor of political science, professor of anthropology, and co-director of the Agrarian Studies Department at Yale University. He's actually kind of a genius, this guy. And it's a beautiful book. It's a small book. And I earnestly advise everybody listening to me to get this book. It will really enlighten you, open your eyes, and not only that, do even something which is even better in these dismal, dreary times. It will encourage you. It will give you a sense that all is not lost and that there is humanity out there if we can only try to organize it and we can try to channel it in a way that changes the way we live. This book, Two Cheers for Anarchism, is an extraordinary piece of work. And essentially, and I wouldn't have the temerity to sum up what a genius writes. And I don't throw that word around lightly, right? You know, like the word hero is thrown around all over the place till it's become base and meaningless, right? Let's welcome our heroes home from Afghanistan. What goddamn heroes? Give me a break. Yes, there's individual heroism. I've been over this before. You're out there, whether you want to be or not, or you volunteered to go out there, all of a sudden you're in tremendous jeopardy. However, you can't withdraw or retreat or run away. Because why? Because your unit or your buddies are in trouble and you put your life at risk and you go to rescue them. That's a form of heroism. The larger context, though, is we don't belong there in the first place. So sometimes I have difficulty when some sports announcer, some moron jock says, you know, we're so proud of our boys and girls overseas defending our freedoms. Jesus Christ. Talk about George Orwell and Aldous Huxley and delusion. Well, genius is also a word that gets thrown around a lot, but I use it very rarely. And I think this guy's a genius. And what he does is make a case in a kind of a benevolent, balanced way. He's not a knee-jerk left-winger. He's not some kind of academician who's off in his own bubble somewhere. But the book is not the easiest book sometimes to read because this guy he lives in a very, very rarefied academic world. And although he's writing, hopefully, to try to persuade other people to understand his point of view and maybe act on it, he does have recourse to many complicated arguments and to sometimes occasionally an abstract theoretical argument, which I have. I don't know about you, but I have trouble following him. I never went very far in school. And one of the reasons is that I cannot follow theoretical abstract reasoning. Now, I know lots of big words. I could even say a few of them here, but I won't throw them away because I don't get paid anything to do that. But it's just to say I don't have the mind for it. You know what I'm saying? Like sometimes in some classes, like philosophy classes, I used to have trouble following philosophy classes. I had trouble following economics classes, but that wasn't because I didn't understand it so much as it's just bullshit. But philosophy, I have trouble following it. But this guy will call upon all kinds of sources. Studies of gardens that are established by Guatemalan Indians, playgrounds that are built specifically with the interests of children really in mind in Holland in the 1970s, things that the Nazis did, things that happened in East Germany. This guy covers the whole world. He seems to know everything. And his basic point is that we need to have more anarchy in our lives, that we are too regulated, we are too stifled, we are too channeled. We live in our own, what was the word that was popular like even up to a year ago? Oh, we're in our own silos. We don't relate to each other, right? For instance, he gives an example, and I can't sum up the whole book, but the general point of the book is that we need anarchy, that institutional systems, either in corporations or in government, that systems which are supposed to work exactly the same way and we're all supposed to obey the rules, and that these laws and these corporate ways of doing things are bad for our souls and really inappropriate for us as human beings, right? And he says, for instance, did you know that the modern public school system, the way people sit in rows and sit in classes and have to be quiet and raise their hands, was established almost exactly at the same time that modern industrial factories were established, specifically in England. And Dickens wrote about this in his novel Hard Times, which is a great novel, but pretty goddamn bleak. I mean, and it's about one of these like factory schools where people, instead of just going there and being tutored or mentored or studying any way they could, when they established these huge sort of factory schools where people had to sit in rows and listen and be taught these rote lessons, which were extraordinarily boring, and memorize things, what these schools were just ways to turn out patriotic, loyal, law-abiding citizens who would be channeled straight into the factories to make the widgets that people were buying and also sit in rows and do little menial tasks all the time. And it's fantastic that he makes these comparisons, right? And this is not something I knew about both things, right? I read Hard Times and I knew about the factory system, right? But he talks about the difference between artisanal work, or what he calls the vernacular, or idiomatic work, things that were particular certain regions, the way people had their own dialects and languages, the way people raised vegetables a certain way because they knew what the soil was like. Any time that you try to impose a huge supervisory predictable order on human beings or on nature, you run into trouble. Remember Jurassic Park? Right? Things go wrong. They spend tens of millions of dollars. What happens is people get very, very, very lofty in the world, like Obama or John Brennan or Michael Bloomberg or anybody like that. And they look at things from, 10,000 miles up. That's not how human beings live 10,000 miles up. They walk around on the streets. They drive around in the desert in trucks. They get their feet wet in the mud, right? This is not how you plan things for human beings. And yet, these factories were built so that everybody did the same thing in the same way at the same time. Of course, the ultimate expression of this is Henry Ford. Henry Ford, in Aldous Huxley's book in Brave New World, they didn't say in the year of our Lord. They said in the year of our Ford, because everything was so automized, everything was so corporatized that everybody had an exact thing to do, and they weren't allowed to do anything else. And if they did, the state punished them. So these schools turned out loyal, patriotic, law-abiding people who then went into factories and became law-abiding, patriotic factories where the machines were really their masters. And people became more and more drunk, more and more lawless, more despondent, more suicides happened all the time. There was more. And what you have is a kind of a meaningless society when this happens. You have a dismal, miserable, meaningless society like we have in this country. Why does everybody in this country take drugs, prescription and non-prescription? More people in this country use drugs per capita, per the population than any other place in the world. Any other place in the world. The reason that so many drugs are sold in this country is because people want them. And why do they drink so much and take so many drugs and watch TV and do all these things in this country more than any other place? Because there's no moral center. There's no meaning, generally, to life in this country. Now, you may have it in your life, and good for you. But generally speaking, this is a meaningless place. There's no sense of humanity here. So this guy writes about this in Two Cheers for Anarchism. And points out exactly, in great detail, with historical examples, how it is that large corporations and governments, and in tandem it's even worse, will dictate things that are unhuman and that are unnatural, so that they ruin the earth and that they ruin people too. And, for instance, in Holland, in the 1970s, they came up with this incredible idea about how to build playgrounds. Instead of just building a playground where there's the swings and there's the slide and everybody line up and do it, and kids got kind of bored doing that, right, a little bit, they just built this closed space. They put a lot of lumber and a lot of tools in there, and they supervised it. They wouldn't let little kids in there because they hurt themselves. And the kids built exactly what they wanted. And it was all idiosyncratic and strange and interesting, right? And so the whole book is examples like that. Like, for instance, one time he was in East Germany on a fellowship. This is way back in the 60s or 70s. And he's in his town way out in the boondocks where you can see for miles. It's flat country, right? And he looks around and there's a traffic light. There's one traffic light in town. Everybody is standing on the corner. They won't cross, even though nobody is coming. And for miles, there's not a car. There's not a train. So he crosses, and everybody starts yelling at him and screaming, And he says, "Why are you standing there in the cold when there's nothing coming?" And they say, "You must not cross against the light." They had no idea why they were standing there. And he tells them, "You know what? If your grandparents were a little less observant of the law," and he means the people during Nazi Germany, "maybe the world wouldn't have suffered so much." This is a really fascinating character and a fascinating book, Two Cheers for Anarchism. All the things I'm talking about today are connected. They're connected. They want you to study, take standardized tests, be good in school, make the right amount of money. What do you think the president wants you to have the American dream for? So you can be asleep. You have to be asleep to have a dream. That's what George Carlin said. They call it the American dream because you have to be asleep to believe it. Okay, that's it for today. I'll be back next week.